Welcome to Viacom's weekly podcast. I am James Serene. I am delighted to be joined by probably the best guest we could have on this week, Richard Spencer, who is the Middle East correspondent based in Beirut for The Times. He's on a brief visit to London, so he's able to be with me today to talk about this incredible story of protests, principally in Lebanon, where we've had the resignation of the Prime Minister there, but also the protests that are taking place in Iraq, and the Prime Minister there has also offered to resign. So, Richard, welcome to the podcast.
Good morning.
If I could just start off by saying, you know, could you characterise for us what is so striking about the protests that are taking place in Lebanon and their result?
The incredible thing about the protests in Lebanon is that they are taking place across the country and in this country that's, as everyone knows, is very divided along sectarian lines. It's happening in all communities. And not only within all communities, but very explicitly aimed by each community at their own leaders. So the slogan is, we mean all of you. So the Sunnis are protesting were protesting against Saad Hariri, who is the figurehead of the Sunni community. He's the prime minister. He was forced to resign. But the Christians are also in Christian areas protesting against the president, who's a Christian under the constitution, Michel Aoun, and particularly against his son-in-law, Gibran Basile, who's the leader of the biggest Christian party in Lebanon. And incredibly significantly, the Shia community have been on the streets of Shia cities like Nabatea protesting against Amal and even Hezbollah, which are the two main Shia factions or parties. And they say they want the leaders of all these parties to resign, all these factions to resign. They're accusing them all of corruption. They're accusing them of strangling the state in this system that ended the Lebanese civil war of dividing power along sectarian lines in a power-sharing way, but has kept the warlords, if you like, the leaders of these factions, in power ever since.
So there, I mean, essentially your characterization is this sort of, it's a very inefficient economy where there's sort of people at the top who are bleeding the state dry and the economy is not allowed to prosper in a way that it possibly could. So what are the main sort of levels of dissatisfaction? I mean, there's very high unemployment, but there's also just there's very low economic growth. I mean, what actually would a functioning government need to do to sort of get things moving and for Lebanon to reach its potential?
Well, the fascinating thing about this also, from looking at it from a kind of more Western perspective, is that these are protests, particularly in Lebanon, where you prosperous middle classes and the working classes. If anything, there are more middle class people there than working class people, because they all have their grievances. The Lebanon is a better off country than most in the Middle East. It's had a sort of Western-oriented free market economy. It's relatively prosperous. But it's on the verge of this economic crisis because the government is heavily indebted. This sectarian system has basically allowed each sectarian faction to buy off its supporters in a sort of a clientelistic and in a very corrupt way, because the leaders of all these factions have squirreled away billions for themselves. So the economy isn't functioning, and of course that means there's high unemployment, which affects the poorer parts of the country the worse, so they're on the street. The government's very indebted. It's running out of foreign exchange reserves. It looks as if it might be on the verge of defaulting on its debts, or at least having to collapse its foreign exchange rate with the dollar, which is key to its openness as a society, as a economy as well. This relationship with the dollar that it has, and to try and stop this, of course, the government's putting in austerity measures. And both the middle classes and the working classes are saying, hang on, why are we paying for this crisis, which is entirely the result of your corruption and your mismanagement of the economy? You know, how come you all stay in place? You know, the leaders of these factions have been in power for 20 years. In some cases, the Shia figurehead, who's the speaker, Nabi Berri, has been speaker for 27 years now. And people are saying, how come you're still there and we have to pay up?
Mm. And what does it mean for some of the other factions? I mean, we've seen this week, for instance, like there was footage of what seemed like Hezbollah sort of operatives who seemed to be sort of beating up protesters. And there's been all sorts of, I think there was a joke on Twitter this morning about, you know, what's going to happen next. And we're waiting for sort of Hassan Nasrallah to sort of like make an announcement and tell the prime minister what he should be doing. Is Hezbollah sort of losing in this in a big way?
Yes, I mean, it definitely is. And Hezbollah's leader, Hassan Nasrallah, had said he didn't want the prime minister to resign. And the prime minister did resign. And over in Iran, which, as we know, is the sort of principal funder and backer of Hezbollah, Ayatollah Khamenei, the supreme leader, sort of yesterday directly accused the protesters in both Lebanon and Iraq of being sort of, you know, stooges for the West, perhaps even put up to it by America and Israel. So they are very unhappy about this. They regard it as a threat because for the first time in Lebanon, particularly, Hezbollah is directly targeted as part of the establishment, part of the regime, if you like, whereas before it's always been the sort of outsider. Now it's actually part in government. It has ministers in government. It is, in fact, possibly the most powerful single organisation now in Lebanon. So it is very much a target. And so Hassan Nasrallah, who, you know, likes to present himself as the outsider, speaking up for the poor and the disenfranchised in Lebanon, suddenly is now torn because he can't just say all these people are just can be ignored, particularly the Shia on the streets of Nabatea and in the southern cities like Sur. But nor can he give in, you know, because he and Hezbollah now have this grip on Lebanon, which they don't want to give up.
Does that, do you think, change the dynamic in terms of what's going on with Hezbollah vis-a-vis Israel? So, for instance, like we've heard a lot over the last few weeks, you know, even since September, where Israel's been talking about Hezbollah trying to build precision missiles in Lebanon. We had the first exchange of fire between of any real significance between Hezbollah and Israel for quite a long time, where an Israeli drone apparently hit a piece of this missile project kit, and in return, Hezbollah fired an IDF base in northern Israel on the border. I mean, do you think there's something there about, you know, is there going to be that same level of support for Hezbollah in the future if it looks like it's sort of threatening the stability of Lebanese life in southern Lebanon? Or do you think that's there's such rock solid support for Hezbollah in the south, particularly, that that's not a factor?
I think there's two answers to that question, the immediate one and the longer term significance. The immediate answer, the immediate incredibly striking thing, as far as I could see in the Lebanese protests, was there was virtually no mention of Israel at all. Right. You know, you went around the protest sites, there were no chants about Israel. No one was talking about geopolitics. No one was talking about Iran. Actually, in Iraq, people were the protests are very geared towards Iran. There's a lot of anti-Iranian sentiment in the protests in Iraq. In Lebanon, that's not the message on the street. The message on the street is very controlled about being against the Lebanese political establishment. Though, as I said before, you know, because of Hezbollah's role now, you can't escape the Iranian significance in that story. So Hezbollah have not been able to come out and say, unlike the Iranian leaders, they haven't really tried to play the Israel card because I think they know that they'd be laughed out of court. This is about Lebanese corruption and that's nothing to do with Israel. In the longer run, it's a very, very sensitive issue because, of course, you know, it's a great distraction. You know, Lebanon is very hostile to Israel. That does go across all the sects. So it would be a very good, easy way of, you know, Hezbollah reuniting the country around its kind of quasi-leadership to somehow escalate the situation in Israel. On the other hand, they have to be very, very sensitive because the political balance between the pro-Iran side of Lebanon and the pro-Western side, the pro-American side, you know, in the last election, you know, the Hezbollah pro-Iran side won a narrow victory, if you like. And that is essentially, in sectarian terms, that is because of the alliance between the Shia, who are pretty united politically, the two main factions, Amal and Hezbollah, are in their alliance with the regime of Assad in Syria and therefore with Iran also. On the one side, you have the Saad Hariri faction, the main Sunni faction, which is pro-Saudi and anti-Iran. On the other side, the Christians are the bellwether who are divided between a pro-Iranian and a pro-Western faction. The pro-Iranian faction currently is in charge, if you like. They have the majority support, or at least the major Christian party is currently allied with Hezbollah. But that is very unpopular in the Christian community. That's seen as a necessity. It was seen as particularly as a necessity when you needed a common front against Sunni jihad. When the Syrian war was on, there was a lot of fear of Sunni jihad spilling over into Lebanon. So there was it was very easy to sell an alliance with Hezbollah and the Assad regime. Now you hear a lot more unhappiness about that, saying, why are we in alliance with Hezbollah and Iran? And in particular, when Hezbollah is being sanctioned by America, and that is putting stress on Lebanese banks, because Lebanese banks are now having to go through their books, see if there's any link with anybody who's, you know, aligned with Hezbollah, any businessman aligned with Hezbollah. Suddenly they're coming under scrutiny because America is putting on sanctions on Lebanese banks. And that's and that is the center of the Lebanese economy. So now the Christians saying, we don't want this. The Christian business community is very, very nervous about the relationship, about what the relationship with Hezbollah has done for Lebanon. So Hezbollah have to pay that very, very carefully.
And what's been the impact of Syrian refugees? I mean, I think there's, more than 1.5 million Syrian refugees in Lebanon? And what's been the discussion about that there in terms of support for those refugees and what might happen in the future?
Again, you know, the extraordinary thing about this protest is that there's virtually no mention of Syria and virtually no mention of the refugees, even though, as you say, there are 1.5 million Syrians. Now, probably about 1 million of those are registered as refugees. Lebanon has always had about 500,000 Syrians living there, working there. They've been treated very badly, it has to be said. The Lebanese state does not want them there. The Christian leaders in particular have been, nakedly racist, really, and determined that they should leave. They've lived in very tough circumstances. They're not allowed to establish formal refugee camps. They want to avoid the repetition of the permanent Palestinian populations in refugee camps that have grown up in Lebanon since 1948. There's a lot of economic debate about the economic effect of the refugees. They're a very easy scapegoat, and that has been used as a scapegoat by the government. The cost of the refugees, but of course it works both ways. The refugees have brought in aid funding. They've brought in their own savings. The wealthier refugees I say wealthy, but in relative terms, you know, some refugees have managed to rent flats or even rent land to build, you know, makeshift refugee camps, and that's brought money into Lebanon when it needed it, actually. So there's a lot of debate whether the presence of refugees is a net negative or positive economically, and certainly if one of the triggers for the current crisis, apparently, so we're told, was after a crackdown in Syria, where the regime went round the prominent businessman and said, you have to hand over money to invest in Syria's future. There was a run on dollars in Lebanese banks as Syrian businessmen brought their money back to Syria. So there's a link there, and it's significant, but it doesn't, you know. If anything, it's notable it's not playing out. People have had enough of excuses. They don't want the government to say, oh, it's all the Syrian refugees' fault. They want the government to take responsibility.
If we could switch now and just focus on Iraq and what's happening there. And it seems like there's been a lot of similarities, you know, very large protests, mushroomed in terms of numbers, complaining about similar things, economic mismanagement, lack of jobs, lack of basic services. I mean, what do you see as sort of some of the big differences as well as the similarities?
Well, I think there's two big differences that's worth focusing on, but perhaps just to stress this similarity first, so the contrast becomes clearer. You know, one thing that is clearly a problem in both countries is the post-war sectarian settlement. Mm-hmm. So the Iraqi system is kind of modelled on the Lebanese system. And the Lebanese system is that you have a Christian president, a Sunni prime minister and a Shia speaker. So the three main sects there are divided, the power is divided up between them. In Iraq, you have a Shia prime minister, a Kurdish president and a Sunni speaker. So you have a similar division of power, which has created a similar problem with factional leaders never being kicked out. You know, the power shifts between the different factions, but you never see the factional leaders themselves get kicked out. And they all have a grip on a bit of the, you know, apparatus of power, which gives them a lot of leverage to bleed money into their pockets, or into their factions' pockets and their allied businessmen's pockets. And that's very much a target of the protests, that system and the way it's exploited and abused, as in Lebanon, is a target. Now, the difference, the two differences, one is the protesters in Iraq are much poorer. Iraq is suffering much more than Lebanon. And of course, suffered, from a much more recent war. And also the other difference is Iraq has oil. So the poverty is all the more striking because everyone knows how much money there is. There's, Iraq has, the third or fourth largest reserves in the world of oil, huge money coming in. And oddly enough, the place where there is the worst poverty in Iraq, which are these very grim southern Iraqi cities, the suburbs of Basra, are, they're very third world, to put it bluntly. They're very tough places, shanty towns, canals full of rubbish, no services, no clean running water, no electricity. And they're sitting on this, Basra is the heart of the Iraqi oil industry. It's sitting on this, one of the world's largest single oil fields is under Basra. And they're saying, where is the money? Where is the money? So there's, in that sense, it's more extreme. The other thing is that because Sunni protest has been discredited because of ISIS, everyone, all the Sunnis in Iraq are afraid of being labelled as jihadists the minute they take up protests against the government. So they haven't joined the protests. And this is an entirely exclusively Shia protest. And given that the targets are often Iranian-backed politicians who are supposed to speak for the Shia community in Iraq, that's all the more striking that you have these massive protests very much targeting an Iranian-led political establishment, but coming from working-class Shia, unemployed young men all across southern Iraq.
And we had a story this week that was covered in a few places about Qasem Soleimani, the head of the IRGC Quds Force, sort of visiting from Iran. And there was even a story that he's chaired some very high-level security meeting, and various people saying that he was, in a way, sort of directing the response of the security services. I mean, that response has been very, very violent. There have been a lot of people killed. I mean, what did you make of that story about Soleimani visiting? I mean, presumably he's in and out quite a lot anyway.
Yeah, I mean, Qasem Soleimani is, it's this extraordinary character who's become a force within the wider Middle East. He was, he came out in a way in the war against ISIS. Before, he'd always been, there weren't many photographs of him before, but in the war against ISIS, he was promoting his own popularity. He was allowing himself to be photographed with Iraqi militia leaders on the front lines in the fighting against ISIS. He has free movement across Iraq, certainly in the areas controlled by the Iran-backed militias. And indeed in Lebanon, where he keeps a much lower profile in Lebanon, but he's certainly been there. It's been made known that he's been there. He himself wrote about being in Lebanon with Hezbollah leaders at the time of the 2006 war with Israel. That he only talked about that more recently, which is, and it's quite interesting that he allowed that information to come out now, all these years later, at this very key moment, saying, look, Iran is a player, I am a player, you cannot ignore me, to the people in Iraq and Lebanon who are protesting. I think this is a naked assertion of power. And he has the purse strings and the military strings over a whole range of militias across Iraq, Syria, and of course Hezbollah in Lebanon. And he's just saying, we are here and we're not going to let the gains we have made in the last decade across this region, we're not going to let anything stand in the way of that. We're not going to let that be reversed, whatever happens. Mm. So I think it's a fairly naked assertion of power.
I mean, that seems to have been the story of the last few weeks for Iran, is that you've got Iranian clients, partners in Lebanon and in Iraq, who are under a huge amount of threat. Their grip on power is being massively challenged. So, you know, there's a moment there that Iran could essentially sort of lose some of that. So that's what you'd expect. Can I ask a much broader geopolitical question? I mean, you're sort of famous for these sort of sketches that you write in the Times, where you sort of set out sort of what the latest event means for the big sort of geopolitical questions of like who's up, who's down. So I wanted to just end with just a final question of like, you know, is it as simple to sum up the last few weeks of what's happened with the Turkish invasion of Syria and the US troops going back and forth, that we have a situation where it really is sort of the US is really a waning in terms of its influence, that it's a real win for Iran and Russia, and that's where things are heading. You know, Assad is winning, Iran and Russia were the big winners the last couple of weeks, and it's the US that's really all over the place. Is that what you sense as well, sitting there in Beirut?
I think, I mean, it's definitely the working out of things, to use a very vague phrase, because of the American drawdown. Mm. I find it fascinating that Trump, you know, came to power on the back of, you know, the denunciation of Obama for his, if you remember, Obama famously said he wanted to balance the Middle East between, you know, Saudi Arabia and Iran, the pro-Saudi and the pro-Iranian factions, which caused absolute outrage in Israel and also in Saudi Arabia and in their supporters in America. And Trump also came to power on the back of denouncing that, what was seen as Obama's naivety. And Trump has really doubled down on that in terms of pulling out and handing much more power over to Iran and to Russia to have their way in these Middle Eastern countries. And I do think that there's a, you know, one of the effects of that in Iraq and Lebanon is people saying, well, hang on a second, what about us? We're the people who live here. This, you know, we didn't want America here. But that doesn't mean to say we want Iran here instead. Now, I think, you know, at the more immediate face of things, I think that it's more about saying, well, if you're going to be here, at least run the place properly. You know, I mean, don't come here and just be even worse than our own corrupt leaders. You know, why are you backing, you know, the worst leaders in our countries just because they're loyal to you? We still have a say here. So that's why it's so interesting. But yes, it's very hard to see Iran now, you know, giving up its gains, or Russia giving up its gains, just because of protests. Mm.
Richard, thank you so much for joining us. That was a real sort of look over all the different elements going on at the moment. And yeah, thank you very much for being with us.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Hi everyone, this is Roni Kazib from BICOM, and I'm thrilled to be joined by Ephraim Sneh on the latest edition of our BICOM podcast. Ephraim is sitting here with me in London, so it's great to have him in person. And he's a retired brigadier general in the IDF who served as the head of the civil administration in the West Bank. And after his service in IDF, he was a member of the Knesset for the Labour Party from 1992 to 2008. And during his time in government, he served as the Minister of Health, the Minister of Transportation, as well as Deputy Minister of Defence. So, Ephraim, thank you so much for being here today. So, given your illustrious military and political career, I was hoping we could just dive in into the current political situation with what's going on. Netanyahu had a shot at forming government but wasn't able to do so, and now Gantz has been given the mandate. Do you think he'll be any more successful in doing that, or do you see us going to a third election?
It's difficult to assemble a new government in the current balance between the blocs, but there are two options. One is a minority government led by Benny Gantz. It's a minority government with the minus that it needs a great deal of political strength and resolve to do things. The other option is unity government, consists of blue-white, Israel Beiteinu, and the Likud, and maybe more parties. It will be a government of paralysis, to be honest, but better paralysis than chaos and third elections. And we had such a government in the past, if you remember, of Shimon Peres and Shamir. It was unity government.
Yeah.
And this government did great things, by the way. Here again, if you speak about the defense and security challenges, this government can work, and the balanced composition of this government assure us that will be no stupid adventures, but a very professional conduct of military operations, if and when needed. You have in this cabinet three former chiefs of staff, Gantz, Ashkenazi, Alon. So, though if they are differ about some things, it assure that there is a very high professional quality of this cabinet, and I hope that's what will happen.
Yeah, so just circling back, you mentioned the security challenges Israel is facing right now. And just earlier this week, we heard the prime minister talk about the threat of the Iranian missiles. And one of the biggest concerns that the military establishment has spoken about is this precision-guided missile technology that Iran is trying to equip Hezbollah with. The prime minister spoke about that technology being in Yemen. So could you flesh that out in more detail and talk about perhaps the severity of the threats Israel is facing right now and why it's therefore even more important for a government to really...
The military entrenchment of Iran in Syria and in other spots in the region is very dangerous because they have the ability to hit the heart of Israel whenever they like, and we should prevent it at all costs. You spoke about the precision guided missiles. It's very dangerous because they may hit what we call high quality targets. Let's speak about energy, electricity, water supply, airport, and they may cause a very dangerous damage to Israel. As you see, I'm very selective in my words, but this is a real threat. They can do it. Though we have effective anti-missile and anti-rocket missiles defense, which is the best in the world, but nothing is 100% proof.
Yeah.
Nothing. And they, all the time, the Iranian, and they try to explore our vulnerabilities.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure that they didn't found vulnerability. So we have to take preemptive measures that they will not even think about to start.
Yeah.
But if they start, we have to retaliate to keep our deterrence.
Right.
And this may deteriorate to a very broad conflict.
Yeah, and it's interesting. You speak about the threat of the precision missile technology, and the severe damage it can do to Israel's infrastructure. And just last week, you wrote a piece for Newsweek, if I recall, about how it is imperative, if I may, that Israel make peace with the Palestinians in light of the American withdrawal from the region. So could you speak about perhaps that, if you see that as a threat to Israel and what it means in terms of its regional alliances and partnerships?
If it was not important, I didn't file an article to the Newsweek about it.
Yeah, of
but
course.
I'll say it briefly. When the United States is outside the region, we and the Arab states, Saudi Arabia, Emirates, Jordan, Egypt, they have no strategic ally to rely on,
mm-hmm.
period. Now, if we, all these countries face such a threat, and look what happened months ago in Saudi Arabia.
Right.
It was a very, very broad, accurate, and effective danger.
Yeah.
Very effective damage.
Yeah.
To the Saudi most important economic facility.
Yeah.
What is more important than the oil of Aramco to the Saudis? And they hit it. And by the way, I'm not doing now marketing, but the defense systems of the Saudis didn't work.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe because they don't use ours.
Yeah.
Okay, but...
possible area of cooperation.
No. So, what I say, I say the following. Only combination of the economic and political strength of Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Emirates, Jordan, and so forth, together with the technological and military might of Israel, can create a regional balance of deterrence. Why does it happen? Because it will not happen as long as the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is not resolved.
Mm-hmm.
If you measure the price of the solution and the reward of the solution and the damages of the status quo, you understand that this is imperative to sit down and talk.
Yeah.
Sit down and talk on which basis? Not the amateurish plan of Mr. Kushner,
mm-hmm.
but we have to take, and this is what I wrote in English, to take the existing pillars, the existing documents of understanding between the parties, which is the Arab Peace Initiative,
mm-hmm.
the Clinton parameters, the General Allen security plan,
yeah.
and most important, the understandings that Ehud Olmert, the Prime Minister of Israel, and Mahmoud Abbas, and the President of Palestine, they agreed in 2008 to take it and to use it as a basis for a new final phase of negotiation.
So perhaps ending on a happy note, you think that it's still possible then for this to be resolved?
If we are going in a clever and responsible way.
Great. Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Always
a pleasure.